Last week we kind of did a general survey of the Old Testament in one night. And so for this semester, we wanted to focus in on the portion of the Old Testament designated as the writings, law, prophet, writings. Ricky reminded us that the Hebrew Bible, usually referred to as the Tanakh, is just the first letters of the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketubim, the law, the prophets, and the writings. And so we're focusing in on the writings designated as such, mainly because they're not the other two. The writings are generally considered to be of a more human origin. Inspired by God, yes, but not in the same way that the prophets are, not in the same way that the law is. The law was given, the law codes especially, given to Moses directly from God. The prophets, in many cases, delivered their messages with the formula, "Thus saith the Lord," and then delivered God's messages. The writings, and the writings really operate in two categories. One is poetry, one is wisdom. Poetry is human expression about God, sometimes to God, sometimes for Him. They're expressions of praise, sometimes they're expressions of complaint or cries for help. Wisdom, on the other hand, is kind of it's the human practice of trying to make sense of the world around us. And the Bible does not have a corner on the market on wisdom. You can look at wisdom literature from every society, both ancient and modern, and you'll find a lot of the principles and a lot of the ideas the same. Now, that being said, there certainly are nuances in the biblical wisdom material that we would believe elevates it, due in part to the inspired nature of Scripture. To say that these are of human origin is not to say that they're not inspired by God, but it is to identify that in that God using human authors and human minds, these writings tend to give their human authors a little bit more liberty, a little bit more freedom to express their own thoughts and their own pain and their own needs for help, their own observations of the world. So we're going to start off with poetry, and we'll spend a few weeks in Psalms, and then we'll look at Lamentations and Song of Solomon, probably a week each. And then we will transition to wisdom literature. We'll spend a few weeks in Proverbs, and then we may spend a couple of weeks in Job. It won't be lengthy. We won't cover all 40 chapters or so of Job. And then a week on Ecclesiastes. The writings also, technically, they kind of include the little short stories, if you will. Ruth and Esther don't fit into the prophets. They're not long enough. They do kind of cover historical material, but they both are situated in the writings, and they kind of stand alone. They're almost, I mean, I use the word short stories because that's kind of what they are. But we may have time at the end of the course to comment on both Ruth and Esther. They're standalone, they're narrative in genre, and so they feel very different than the wisdom in the writings, the wisdom in the poetry, but they do qualify as writings per strict categorization. So you see on your notes the scope of poetry in the Old Testament really is not confined to just Psalms. We have Psalms all over. The Song of the Sea is in Exodus 15. That's a psalm. A psalm, an expression of praise and thanks pending or following, I should say, the deliverance of the Israelites at the sea. The Song of Moses, Deuteronomy 32. It's kind of a, I don't know if refrain is the right word. I mean, Deuteronomy 32 is drawing near the end of Moses' life. And this Song of Moses is offered there in Deuteronomy. Of course, the Song of Deborah in Judges 5. It's interesting because Judges, the entirety of the rest of the book is narrative, but this single chapter is designated as a psalm of victory from Deborah, which is peculiar as to why that happens to be included. Song of Hannah in 1 Samuel 2, the prayer of Habakkuk in Habakkuk 3, and then it was commented on last week. I don't know if it was this session or the Thursday morning session was simply a repeat for people that didn't come Wednesday night. In one of those, we talked about how the prophets are largely poetic, and many people have a hard time reading them because it's just slower going. It's not as captivating to our imaginations as story can be. And Psalms can be very bite-sized. You can read a psalm sometimes in just a couple of minutes. Some of those prophetic oracles can get really lengthy. And if you read several chapters back to back to back, they can also get somewhat redundant. I mean, the prophetic themes are not that varied. The Israelites were wicked. God was calling them to repent. The different examples, sometimes you get different examples, but the themes themselves were about pending judgment in most all of those cases. So you have poetry throughout the Old Testament. So our attempts at learning how to understand it and read a little bit better don't just apply to the book of Psalms. They apply much more widely than that. In addition to isolated poetic passages, the entirety of the books of Psalms, Lamentations, and Song of Solomon are comprised of poetic writings. So, yes? In my opinion, it is. Yeah, it's as we get in here and we look at characteristics of poetry, you're going to see some of them are very, very obvious. They're obvious and they're omnipresent in the Psalms. They're not as present in Genesis 1. In Genesis 1, it's a lot more themes and repeated refrains, which are poetic devices, but so definitely not of the same caliber, but carrying similar characteristics, I guess. So, good example. Poetry. I'm not sure why it is we endear ourselves with the Psalms. I think as modern Christians, even over the last 100 years, we value the Psalms a great deal, but I don't know that we value all of them. We pick and choose. There are certain ones that the imagery in them has kind of become entwined in our religious experience. Walking through the valley of the shadow of death, of course, is most notorious. Can y'all think of others? Psalm 51, David's psalm of repentance is one. As the deer panteth for streams of water. We've incorporated a lot of psalms into modern, well, both in hymns, but also a lot of modern choruses, praise choruses, have borrowed from the psalms. Better is one day in your courts. I'd rather be different translations render it differently, a servant in the temple of my God than a thousand, spend a day there than a thousand elsewhere. Poetry in our world as a whole, it hasn't a place, but I don't know how many people really cherish just regularly reading poetry. If you collect books and buy poetry, some people do, but any of you on occasion? We do have to read Iliad and the Odyssey. We do have to read Shakespeare in verse, stories that are told from previous centuries. But man, it doesn't matter whether you're a high school kid or a college kid. Few are the students that really cherish reading, ancient Greek epic poetry or Shakespearean verse. But poetry does have a very prominent place in our world in music. That's kind of where, most of us, if we identify where we come into contact with poetry most often, it's in song. And I'm not so sure that it wasn't that different in the ancient Hebrew context. There's a whole world of study on trying to figure out how psalms were used in the Old Testament world. Unfortunately, there's not a instruction manual to them. There's just examples of psalms, but it doesn't tell us how they were used. And so we can make educated guesses, but we do believe that corporate worship was one of those ways. They were used in temple worship, festivals, celebrations, that what we have is perhaps something of a hymnal for the ancient Hebrew community. But we don't know that for sure. How much singing did they do? Probably a fair bit, but we don't really know. Scope of poetry there throughout the entire Old Testament. Any other comments or thoughts or questions? When we start talking about these characteristics, keep in mind that these are observations made by readers centuries removed. Again, we don't have a Hebrew primer on poetry that explains it for us. So it's like most study of ancient cultures, we're creating systems by which to categorize things we've observed, but these are not cut and dry and they're not foolproof. In the 1700s, around 1753, a German scholar observed a device that he wasn't German, his last name was Loth, L-O-W-T-H-E, I think he was British. He coined this term parallelism, and it has stuck in the world of biblical studies for the last 200 plus years. A nice summary definition you see there under parallelism number one: the echoing of thought positively or negatively in successive lines of poetry. The way you may have heard me describe this, if you've been in a setting where I've talked about it, is that the Hebrew poets rhymed with images instead of sounds, which is convenient when you have texts that are translated into different languages. If you're rhyming with images, they translate. If you're rhyming with sounds, they don't. Always. You can spend a great deal of time trying to make, you know, an English song rhyme in Spanish or vice versa, but it doesn't always work that well. What it means is the rhyming is visual instead of auditory. Let me give you some examples and see if you can see it. There are several identified types of parallelism. The most common is referred to as synonymous parallelism, where the second line simply repeats the idea of the first. For example, Psalm 139, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence?" The second line says exactly the same thing as the first. In fact, it is quite redundant. It's just using different words to say the same thing. And so, even if the artistry of the verse is not in rhyme, the artistry of the verse is in variety in language. I'm not great with Spanish, but I've spoken enough with translators. And one of the things that I value about the English language is we've begged and borrowed from so many other languages, and our vocabulary is so dense that I can find four or five different ways of saying the same thing. And I don't know if I'm giving away any secrets, but if you pay attention to me when I preach, sometimes I do this. I'll say something, and then I'll say the exact same thing with different words. And I don't know that I do that on purpose. It's just a rhetorical device. But that's what Hebrew poets would do. I would do that when lecturing in Spanish, either in sermons or in lectures, and I'll say something, and then they'll translate it, and then I'll say something with different words, and they'll translate the exact same thing. Not every language has as many different ways of saying things as ours does, but this really is, not only is it an artistic device for poetry, but it's a huge help in translating sometimes with obscure Hebrew words. If we have obscure words and we're not really sure what they mean, if they pop up in verse, in Psalms, then a parallel line can really kind of help us figure out maybe what that word signifies or what it means. The device is a huge help in that context too. A couple of other examples there, just of synonyms. O God, do not keep silent. Be not quiet, O God, be not still. Slight development on the second one, but still you can see the lines are synonymous. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? They're similar pictures, Nate. I think that's what I'm getting at, is that it's rhyming with images. So what you see in line one is the same thing you see in line two. It's just using different words to describe it.
Does the Hebrew always use different words too?
Yeah. More often than not. Largely it does. If you got a Bible, I mean, go anywhere random in Psalms. Find a psalm. See if you can find an example of a parallel, a synonymous parallel.
Would it have been a help to appealing to the literate population to have the picture repeated?
Absolutely. Very much so. Yeah. Very much so. It was a device for memory. Yeah, a mnemonic, if you will. Anybody find one? A parallel line? If you find one, read it for us. Anybody?
Seek ye the Lord, that you may be found. Call upon him when he's near.
Very nice. They're synonymous. And sometimes there might be a slight, you know, slight variance, but in fact, there is a device in parallelism where you're going to see down here there's a synthetic style where the second line, it's kind of a cause and effect, where the second line speaks to the effect of the first or a development from the first idea.
I also find it kind of instructive too, like they see the Lord, okay, how do I do that? Mm-hmm. Call upon him when he's near.
Yeah, yeah, good observation. Anybody else find one? Yeah. Perfect.
A day in your courts is better than a thousand outside. I would rather stand at the threshold of the house of my God than dwell in the den of wickedness.
Yeah. And those two, that's a much longer example, but those two lines are illustrating the same thing. That example that Charles read might be qualified as the second one here, symbolic. And there are some scholars, again, this is not a cut and dry system. This is our way of observing and analyzing. But some would say that symbolic is just a part of synonymous. You're creating a synonym. You're just using a symbol, a metaphor, perhaps, to do that. As a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. Those are synonyms, but it's kind of it's for the purpose of comparison, perhaps. So, anybody else find a synonymous example?
Alpha
and Omega. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You find, when you pick up on this, you find that it's pretty common in a lot of places. And what is this? I mean, does this do anything for us theologically? Sometimes, and it can. I mean, it can draw our attention. But more often than not, I think it was just like poetry. Poetry is divine. It's designed to be creative and artistic and beautiful, and in some cases to help us remember. It serves a little bit more of an artistic purpose maybe than the theologically rigid attention that we give to Scripture at times. And so it's a way of just observing and identifying beauty within, you know, within the poetry of the Scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very much so. Where are you at, Ricky? What chapter and verse? All the nations surrounded me, but in the name of the Lord I cut them off. They surrounded me on every side, but in the name of the Lord I cut them off. They swarmed around me like bees, but they died out as quickly as burning thorns. In the name of the Lord, I cut them off.
Yeah.
Swarming bees. Poetry, I mean, really, it becomes richer if you read it more slowly. And if you really do try to give attention in your mind to the imagery it's portraying. That's not a discipline that comes naturally, I think. It didn't for me. And maybe it doesn't. Yeah, for a lot of us, but you have to kind of slow down. It's the literary equivalent of stopping and smelling the roses as you're walking by outside. You catch something and you kind of have to pause, and enemies surrounding them like a swarm of bees. That is pretty potent. But if you just kind of read through as if it's a race to get through the chapter or to get through the psalm, then you fly by it. Yeah, exactly. You can go to just about any psalm and you'll find them. And sometimes there'll be nuances, but I mean that's how art is, right? There are little nuances all along the way. So sometimes more often than not, the parallels are synonymous. Sometimes the parallels are opposites. The third category there, antithetic, is a repetition, but instead of paralleling the idea, it parallels the former with a contrasting idea. For example, for evil men will be cut off, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. Also from Psalm 37. Psalm 1, the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. I think about reading books to my kids when they were little. I mean, those little opposites, contrasts, we see those in kids' literature and children's books a lot. We see them in modern songs, too. Part of the way that you paint the picture is by holding up the opposite next to it so that you can see what it is you're talking about. A little bit harder to find. These are not quite everywhere. I don't know if you can think of any, or if you stumbled across any a while ago while you were looking for synonyms.
They seem to be quite prevalent in Proverbs.
Very much so. Very much so. In fact, Proverbs is going to use this antithesis style of device for many of the things that it has to say. Come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation. That's a synonym. Let us come before him with thanksgiving and extol him with music and song. That's a synonym. For the Lord is the great God, the great King above all gods. In his hands are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. It's all, synonymous. Is everywhere. Antithetical, you'll see them pop up from time to time, but not nearly as prevalent. Yeah, Ricky? 136? There are, and I don't know if this is one of them. What part of it are you looking at? All of it. Yeah, his love endures forever. Mm-hmm. It's more of a refrain, a different device. In fact, back to what we're talking about with Genesis 1, that refrain kind of style, you don't see that as much in the Psalms, but that is it's a poetic device. Sometimes you'll see a psalm on a couple of occasions that feels very much more like wisdom. And that's a style, but that's, those are much more isolated. Parallelism, again, is not universal in the Psalms. It's just a very prevalent device, like poetry that we would look at. You'll find some kind of devices. Some poems will rhyme, some won't. Some will use similar consonants and some won't. Some will use similar beginnings and endings of words, and some won't. It's the artistry of incorporating different, you know, verbal auditory devices. And you'll see some there that Hebrew does that as well, and some of those can be lost in translation, but this one fortunately is not.
Mm-hmm. But it's like, how many different ways can you say the word law, statute, precept, decree, command? It goes on and on and on. I always thought that was interesting, but I was never quite sure what kind of format that really entails.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be synonymous?
Psalm 119 is a little bit different, and we'll come to it in a moment. Yeah. No, it's okay. It is, because Psalm 119 is so much longer and has so many more lines, it does tend to mount parallel on top of parallel, which is part of what makes it a little bit more grand. Yeah, it's. I mean, in literary terms, it's a grander work of art than some others for those reasons. The bottom one, synthetic parallelism, is where the second line specifies the result of the initial action. I've given you a little bit longer passage from Psalm 40. I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear the Lord and put their trust in him. And even within those lines, you see some synonyms, but overall you see a synthetic flow. This leads to A, leads to B, leads to C, leads to D, leads to E. Very much a cause and effect style of progression. Part of, for me, in just enjoying reading Psalms and reading poetry in the Old Testament is knowing what to look for. Did you feel that way when you had to read the Iliad and the Odyssey, or you had to read Shakespeare? They throw in all of these modern day references to people and events and places, and if you don't know them, then you just kind of get lost. And then all of a sudden they started putting out annotated versions of Shakespeare, where they'll have kind of like study Bibles, where they'll put at the bottom, you know, when Shakespeare references somebody and you don't know who it is, he'll tell you, he'll give you a little note. This is who that is. This is where that's taking place. Or if there's a really peculiar turn of phrase in Old English that you don't get, then they'll file that down there and tell you what it means. All of a sudden knowing what to look for makes it so much more enjoyable. And I've found personally for that to be the case in reading Psalms, just seeing these little, you know, devices at play causes me to slow down, causes me to read it more carefully, more intentionally, and causes me to pick up on some of those images a little bit better. Parallelism is not the only device. It's just a device that we really don't use in English so much, in modern English, and it's been observed and kind of given a lot of attention by Old Testament scholars. Some of these others, word pairs, I don't know that we do that as much, but there are in several of the ancient Near Eastern languages, they'll use word pairs that just kind of go as a device. It's kind of like a sing-song style of device, and that may not resonate as much with you, but I'm sure you remember times reading through and 1,000 of this and 10,000 of that go together. Or God's unfailing love and God's compassion go together. Or transgressions and sins, they're word pairs that they appear together often. Maybe we do have those in English. I don't know that we use them so much in our writing or our literature. But, you know, when someone says Jack, then you think of, yeah. When someone says salt, you think of, you know, we have a lot of these little word pairs that they just kind of, by the rhetoric of our culture, they tend to go hand in hand. And from a biblical, are y'all thinking of others? What's that? Light and darkness? Yeah, which is a biblical one too. Come on, Stephen, you had to have thought of one. You didn't come up with a word pair, modern day? Perhaps. I'd say apples and oranges, maybe. You see those in Psalm 91:7 and many other places. You'll find 1,000 and 10,000. And have you ever read that? Let's look at that in particular. You know, those usages of 1,000, 10,000. Yeah, it feels like we want to read that literally and say, wait a minute, why 1,000 here and 10,000 there? As though we're looking for scientific specificity. But that's not the purpose. The purpose is to create this mounting, it's almost like a hyperbole. Psalm 91:7, 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand. Well, which is it? Is it 1,000 or is it 10,000? You know, it's not trying to be specific. It's trying to create this poetic development that speaks to a lot. That's the point of communicating it, more than you can count. Number sequences, Psalm 62:12. I didn't put all of these, I didn't write them all out, so we can scavenger hunt and track them down. Psalm 62:12, you'll recognize these two, and you'll have seen these and may not really have paid much attention to them. We just kind of read past them. One thing God has spoken, two things have I heard. Yeah, that you, O God, are strong, and that you, O Lord, are loving. That numerical sequence of one here and two there. Well, which one, you know, God spoke one thing, I heard two. Don't try and think about it too precisely. Think about it as it's an artistic device, a literary device. It is a poetic device that we don't use, and so it feels a little bit foreign to us. Acrostics. I think Psalm 9 and 10 are both examples. Ricky, do you have your Hebrew Bible there? Could you look at Psalm 9? Is it? I don't remember if my notes were right there. Psalm 9, where each successive line would be Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet. It's not. That may be. Much of Lamentations is in acrostic form. Look at Psalm 119. Back to what Candy was talking about. You should have in your Bible little subheadings where it gives you characters of the Hebrew alphabet and their names. Mine has that. Yes? Committed to memory, committed to, there's another whole field of study in the Old Testament trying to identify the oral traditions behind the written Psalms, which is asking that very question. Did these just come into being when they were written down? Perhaps some of them, yes. Or did some of them have a life in the culture of Israel orally for generations and generations before they were written down? And chances are, for some of them, the answer is also yes. But, you know, without hard and fast information, all we're doing is, you know, trying to make educated guesses based on other things we find in the culture and in the archaeological record. Psalm 119, in a basic acrostic, and if you look in Lamentations, for example, Lamentations 1, each successive verse begins with a consecutive character in the Hebrew alphabet. It would be like if you're, you know, we do these where you spell out your name. You know, I think my kids had to do this in elementary school. You write out your name, and then you have to write adjectives that start with S and then with T and then with E and then... Yeah. Yeah. So each one of the Psalms and Lamentations is an acrostic. And the fifth one, I don't remember precisely how it plays out. We'll revisit that when we get to Lamentations. But in Psalm 119, when you're looking at verses 1 through 8, each of the eight lines begins with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And then when you get to verses 9 to 16, each of the eight lines begins with the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And then you go to the next eight and the next letter in the Hebrew alphabet. So it's acrostic style all the way from A to Z with the Hebrew alphabet. Again, this is it's a literary device that we completely lose in English, but it's pretty cool to know that. And our English translations, in many cases at least, have pointed that out to us by giving us, breaking down the sections and giving you the Hebrew character and its name. You can kind of pick up on that. But the acrostic, they're not always this elaborate. Again, the one in Psalm 119 is the most elaborate of all. But there are a couple of other places in the Psalms that utilize this device, and also in Lamentations. Paronomasia is used, which is a technical way of speaking about puns, a play on words with the same or similar sounds, but different meanings. These will pop up in the Psalms from time to time. Really, they're used more in the prophets than they are in the Psalms. The one that is, I think it, is it Jeremiah? I think it's in Jeremiah. Where Jeremiah has a vision. Let's see if I can find it real quick. Does anybody know where it is? Jeremiah does, I think. Hosea does. Oh, there it is. It's Jeremiah 1. Sorry. Jeremiah 1, verse 11. The word of the Lord came to me. What do you see, Jeremiah? He says, I see a branch of an almond tree. The Lord said to me, you have seen correctly, for I am watching to see that my word is fulfilled. Well, what does one have to do with the other? Yeah, and in Hebrew, the word for branch is, what is it? Yeah. And the word for probably watching? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a play on words that we don't get here. And then he does the same thing. What do you see? Verse 13, I see a boiling pot tilting away from the north. The Lord said to me, from the north disaster will be poured out on all who live in the land. I'm about to summon all the peoples. What's that? Yeah. Can you think of an example off the top of your head? Yeah, this play on words happens a lot in visions. God will show them a vision, and they'll see the vision, and they'll say, ah, here's what that means. And it doesn't have anything to do with an almond tree. It has something to do with God, you know, watching. But there's a derivative of the word that's played upon. Yeah. If you know what you're looking for. And it's one of those things, I mean, our English translators, they try and incorporate these things when they can. There's just some places that's just really hard to do. So, some places it's impossible to do. But it's nice to know. I mean, I don't know that our theology is really tied up in this. There's an artistic element that we may lose, but. Did you find one? Okay, we'll come back to it. Another one that is not lost in translation is number 5, anthropomorphisms. My kids learned that in, you know, middle school English. That is giving human characteristics to unhuman things, or animate qualities to inanimate objects. You're anthropomorphizing it. You're morphing it into an anthropos, turning it into a person. And so trees clap their hands, rocks cry out, the heavens declare the handiwork of God, things like this. Right. Gotcha. Gotcha.
Did you say that, for example, Genesis 1
mm-hmm.
is anthropomorphic? For example, okay, it says God said.
Yeah. I don't think Genesis 1 is anthropomorphic. I think Genesis 1 uses, it's using a lot, it does use play on words, but the play on words in Genesis 1 have more to do with the ancient Near Eastern world and what other peoples around them believed. For example, when it talks about the greater light and the lesser light, that seems to be a poetic way of not saying, we know what that is, but Genesis 1 specifically doesn't say the sun and the moon, because those words were also names of deities identified with the sun and the moon by the Egyptian culture on the sun case, the Babylonian culture on the moon's case. And so it's little plays like that, you know, if you know what to look for, then they jump out at you a little bit.
But what if, for example, like in Genesis 2, mm-hmm. when he's walking in the garden with Adam and the fool, isn't that?
Genesis 2 transitions into narrative.
Okay.
Yeah, Genesis 2, 3, really, and that's part of the challenge is, you know, people look at Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and there seems to be conflicting episodes. In Genesis 1, it seems that God created humanity, and in Genesis 2, God creates man first, and he creates woman. You know, are there two different occasions? Well, no, but one of them is telling this is communicating the event in narrative form. One of them is communicating it much more as kind of a poetic opera, you know, is the way that I think of it. The refrains are one of the key devices. And God said, let there be, and there was, and God saw, and it was good. There was evening, there was morning. And it just kind of keeps repeating that refrain over and over and over again. You don't get it every time, yeah.
Day, evening and morning.
Right.
Right.
Speaking
to a 24-hour day, evening and morning.
Unless, of course, it's poetic.
That would be a good way to
true.
This and not take it seriously in my way.
Oh, I would beg to differ, though. I don't think that it's not taking it seriously. I think that it is, it's trying to identify the literature according to the way that it was intended to be shared. And ultimately, we don't know the answer to that question. I mean, all we can do is use the clues that we have, but it's, I think both approaches are taking it seriously. They just end up in different conclusions. That's fair.
It's just a symbolic, it's just
yeah.
a myth, it's just a story.
Yeah.
You know how Genesis is up to God.
What's the logical term? That's where the conclusion doesn't follow the observation. There's a logical term for that kind of argument.
Yeah.
No. It doesn't follow. In other words, it's nunc et dimittis. What is that? Well, what they're doing is they're saying, because it's using figurative language, it's not true. And that conclusion does not follow from that observation. Just because you're using figurative language doesn't mean that what you're describing, because we'd say Revelation does the same thing. Yeah, we would say Revelation is using highly figurative language and communicating truth. Sometimes we'd say that's a straw man. You're erecting a case just for the purpose of, you know, setting it on fire. But it's not a real case.
Don't you think the evil one would love to
people do that.
Believe it to be true.
Yeah.
To weaken your faith or something like that.
Yeah.
So, for example, in Ezekiel,
uh-huh.
I mean, that imagery is amazing.
Really strong. I think it's a vision almost. I mean, the prophets had visions a lot, and what they're doing simply is, I think, they're just reporting back what they've seen, what God has shown them. And in that case, God is, it's not anthropomorphism, it's almost a metaphor, or a simile, if you will. This valley of dry bones is like Israel, and Israel is dead and dry, but I'm going to breathe life back into them.
Synonymous?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, symbolic, maybe. I mean, if we're going by just these options, it's much more of a symbolic case. It's not an exhaustive list of characteristics. I mean, you can go and read works on the writings that identify all kinds of stuff. When we get into Psalms next week, specifically, we'll look at different types of Psalms, what purposes they served. But just from a poetic literary device, these are a few things to look for. Possible functions in the life of Israel. We'll look at this question much more in depth next week. But it seems to be apparent that the Psalms and poetry was used as personal expressions to God, or for God. They were to God in giving thanks to Him for something He had done. They were to God in crying out to God for help. Or they were for God in the form of praising Him for something. Praising Him for something He had done. Praising Him for a characteristic of His that they were admiring. They were personal expressions to God. That was both a challenging but also an eye-opening statement in seminary for me, was that in the Psalms we have less words from God and more their words to God. And you know what? We need inspired examples of words to God, because it helps us understand, you'll see that on that last category, helps us understand how we communicate to God. Whenever we are dying and on the cross, where does Jesus go to borrow words to communicate His agony and pain? He goes to the Psalms. We also identify that these were likely used as music of the temple, most likely that they were most likely at home, not at home, but the Psalms' place of residence was during the celebrations of great events, festivals, etc., and also perhaps music used in corporate worship. So these are some theories that are pretty well-educated guesses. For our purposes, the question is not only how they were used in Israel, but how can they be used by us? How can we interpret them and use them in our own personal life? The Psalms are poetry, and by nature they're created to express emotion, more so than doctrine. I should say more so than doctrine, maybe not, instead of not doctrine. You can pull doctrine out of the Psalms, but there's a common habit among certain areas of theologians, and they like to build their theological points by pulling a single verse out of a psalm and saying, look here, this is a theological point. And you really can't do that. You can't pull a single line out of a songwriter's song and say, look, this proves that such and such songwriter was this. They're expressions of poetry, for one. Their personal expression, sometimes they're born out of deep emotion, sometimes born out of deep grief and pain. To attempt to develop a systematic theology based solely on a psalm robs it of its very nature. Now, if you come across a theological idea that you see represented throughout Scripture, and you find it represented in the Psalms too, that's completely different. But the use of psalms exclusively to create theology, probably not the best way of developing theology. The Psalms use highly expressive language, simile, metaphor, hyperbole, in their descriptions that was meant to be interpreted figuratively. Enemies spew swords from their lips. That's a good image too. Mountains skip like rams, anthropomorphism. And God is described as a shield, a rock, a shepherd, a warrior. In one of the prophetic books, he's dry rot. Sometimes they're very flattering images, sometimes not so much. Each psalm should be approached as an entire literary unit. Remember that they are personal expressions or prayers, words not from God, but to God and about God. They are the human response to the divine encounter. And then fourth and finally, contemporary uses can be for personal or corporate worship, to show us how to be open and honest with God, and to help us speak to God in tough times. Those are possible contemporary usages. Not the entire list, just a start for thinking. So we'll look at psalm types, categories, next week, and then we'll spend a couple of weeks just walking through some specific ones case by case. But hopefully that gives you a little bit of appreciation on the literary style of poetry, and as you read through them, you can pick up on some of those things on your own.